You're listening to a stage talk titled Studying Russia's Digital Grasp with Dr. Marielle Weimers. Our conversation this week focused on Russia's digital strategies or lack thereof and their internet governance. We explored how actors within and outside Russia have acted to try to circumvent or combat those controls and what we can do as researchers to continue to study RussiaNet. You can find all of the links mentioned in the talk in the description of this podcast. The talk was hosted by me, Charlotte Marr, on Thursday, the 8th of November, 2024, in the Bellingcat Discord server. Hi, everyone, and welcome to this week's stage talk with speaker Dr. Marielle Weimers. Marielle is an assistant professor in internet governance at Maastricht University. She conducts research on internet freedom and the human rights implications of internet policy and platform governance. Much of her work focuses on the acts of authoritarian regions like Russia with internet censorship. She's currently working in a Horizon Europe consortium studying strategies for information control beyond borders with an emphasis on information suppression. But today she is here to discuss Russia's grasp on digital spaces. We'll be talking about everything from recent developments on Telegram to Russian bots. As we talk, please put your questions in the chat and I'll make sure to ask them as we move into the Q&A section. As I just mentioned, if you do not want me to include your name in your question, please write that within your question. Okay, Mario, go ahead and take the stage.
Great. Thank you so much. So first of all, I very much want to thank the organizers for the invitation. It's really a pleasure to be here and to be able to talk to you today about how Russia tries to control all digital flows. So in this opening talk, 20 minutes or so, I'll be focusing mostly on the domestic dimension of that. So how Russia has been trying to control the internet within Russia. But of course, there are many transnational dimensions to that as well, as was already mentioned. And that's something that in much more recent research, we're also moving towards, that we're looking into more. So I'm very happy in the Q&A to also broaden the scope and to look beyond what has been happening in Russia domestically. But let's get started, I would say. I'm very much looking forward to the discussion later on. So I wanted to start off with something much more recent. So over the past summer, there was a further escalation of Russian internet censorship, and one which we have been waiting for almost 2 years. So finally, after much waiting, indeed, YouTube has become throttled. So pretty much limited in usage to the point where it's very difficult to actually use. Because, of course, as I think many in this audience will know, as soon as you limit the bandwidth, something like a video sharing platform will basically become very useless. But the reason why I say something we've been waiting for 2 years is that over the past 2 years, or ever since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, they've really accelerated internet censorship and started blocking several of these large Western social media platforms. But surprisingly, not YouTube. And this is surprising since it is such an important platform, especially for Russian independent journalism from abroad, Russian opposition, to be able to reach Russian audiences. It's one of those few bridges that still existed between the Russian audiences and those abroad. So now, indeed, they have moved forward with this, but at the same time, what this continues to be quite strange is that officially they deny that this is actually the Russian government doing it. They tried to put the blame on Google servers are no longer being serviced, and that this is the actual reason. So the jury is still out, but I think all experts agree that it actually is the Russian government that is now restricting YouTube. So again, this is the latest development in more than 10 years of increasing restrictions on the Russian internet. And Russia also is not unique. So throughout the world, we see that the trend in terms of internet freedom is very negative. So Russia is one example where internet has become more and more restricted, but this actually is a global trend where internet freedom is declining. For example, if you would look at the rankings by Freedom on the Net, you can see various examples of what different shapes that this takes, but the overall trend is very negative. So we see various repressive regulations. We see a lot of examples, increasingly of blockages of social media or even full internet shutdowns. Russia is one of those examples that I think is very interesting from a research perspective as well, because it has really shifted from one opposite to the other opposite. So Russia's internet has developed fully integrated into the global internet. It is quite distinct because it had a very thriving domestic internet sector as well. So Russian tech companies, Russian platforms, and so on. But now, of course, it has gone all the way to the other opposite. So become quite highly censored and also more and more isolated from the global internet. So how has this actually come about? That is what I've been doing research on for the past years. How has Russia shifted from this, the internet, using it as this also a tool for economic development, for education, and so on, really coming to a highly digitized society, to now undermining that more and more and more? How have you went to from this open internet to a censored, isolated internet? But where I push a little bit against some of the more common narrative is that, yes, it is about what the Russian government does. It is about Russian policy, for example, Russian legislation. But of course, there's much more to that, because the internet infrastructure is so complicated. It exists with so many components and so many different owners, for example, of those different components, that actually it's quite difficult for authoritarian states to censor. You often need to pressure some of these, for example, infrastructure owners to actually implement your censorship. So the question then obviously becomes, what role do platform companies, for example, have in this switch towards more and more censorship? So how should we understand the role of platform companies in internet censorship in Russia? So zooming out, I just want to give you just a way of thinking about internet censorship. If we can actually imagine it as a spectrum, where on the one hand, we have an internet with no restriction, this actually is not necessarily beneficial. So if we approach this from a human rights perspective, for example, then this would not be a beneficial situation. We need some forms of regulation, we need some forms of control. On the total opposite, we have complete internet shutdown, so no internet whatsoever. But these are the two extremes within which we are, and within which we try to find this sweet spot where indeed the internet is functional, it is secure, we are able to protect human rights, but at the same time, we're not transgressing into restrictions that actually we do not want. So the reason why I want to present it as a spectrum is also because the ways in which we can censor the internet is very, very diverse. There's all these different forms that go from the more benign or potentially benign, like a government requesting a platform to remove illegal content. They can be totally permissible, right? Just a normal way to enforce legislation. It can also be, of course, repressive. This also happens. And towards more the extreme end, we see examples such as blocking social media. And this we would already see as being very problematic because it rarely is proportional. So the kind of strength that a state might want to prevent, it most often doesn't justify really blocking an entire social media platform, which affects a lot of users, a lot of different kinds of communications. So the one is more on the good end and the other is more on the bad end. But it's especially this middle part that I'm always very interested in. So all of the individual actions, but also the less visible actions that actually really influence how users, and especially users in authoritarian states, are able to use the internet. So another more abstract visualization of how indeed the Russian internet has developed. So as I'm sure you know, on the one hand, we have officially a global open internet. At the same time, within that, there's a lot of different communities and a lot of different different bubbles, almost you can say. Even if you just imagine the different language spaces that we inhabit, different communities that we are part of. At the same time, most of that you are technically able to access. And this, of course, is what the major shift is that has now been happening in Russia, where they've been moving from this integration between, on the one hand, the global open internet and also the Russian and Russian language internet, which of course transcended Russian borders, to more and more trying to isolate Russian users from this global internet. So trying to pull them onto Russian platforms, off from foreign platforms, and to really try to keep them, as well as their traffic, as well as their data, within the boundaries of the Russian state. On the one hand, this is justified as security as well. They're defending national security, maybe even defending the security of Russian citizens when it comes to data privacy. But of course, what it also does is that it censors. So what do they try to deprive Russian citizens from is access to information. So for example, access to information about war crimes committed by the Russian army. But more and more, there's this isolation. But at the same time, it's important to always stress that this is not complete yet. And of course, YouTube was one of those bridges in between, but we still have, for example, also Telegram that really is somewhere there. But the bridge is becoming more narrow. So for example, with increasing restrictions even on VPNs, so it's becoming more and more difficult for those on the outside to get information into Russia, as well as vice versa. So if you think, in again, an abstract form about how Russia tries to control the information, then there's actually two kinds of activities or two objectives at the same time. So on the one hand, they try to increase the production and the reach of the narratives and the sources that they are promoting. So think, for example, about RT or about Russian perspectives on political affairs. So they try to promote the reach of these. This is also why Russia is very annoyed by the fact that Russian state media is banned on YouTube worldwide. And the opposite is to suppress the narratives and the sources that they do not want. So this would be, for example, a Russian independent media like Meduza. They're trying to restrict as much as possible the reach of such information. So it's always a combination of both of them. We tend to look either or, but of course the propaganda and the censorship, they are mutually reinforcing. So they try to recreate the information landscape in such a way that it helps promote the propaganda and suppress the independent information. And to, of course, also suppress citizens expressing themselves, citizens organizing, citizens resisting. And how do they do this? There are actually different ways in which you can go about this, different ways of targeting the information infrastructure. So when you think about it, the more traditional way is to go after the production of information. So to repress journalists, for example, to intimidate them, to intimidate citizens, to reinforce self-censorship. These are really traditional forms of repression, to try to prevent information from being produced in the first place. So if you, for example, shut down a media organization, then this would be here. We also have things like organizations labeled as foreign agent or being declared undesirable organization. Those would all be on this end. So today we'll be talking a bit less about this and more on the other two. And these are about dissemination and visibility. So the information dissemination is, okay, it has been produced, but you can then still try and limit how far it can actually go. So to limit it from being spread elsewhere. And visibility is, okay, it's out there, it has been disseminated, but it can be more visible or less visible. So more recommended to users or less recommended to users. So I want to just go through two examples of both of those. That's what my research has been focusing on mostly. So let's start with this dissemination of information. This is particularly the dimension where we see the role of platforms become very, very prominent. And what has been fascinating for me to follow over the past years is this continuous conflict between the Russian government and these various platform companies. So both Russian companies like Yandex, like VK, as well as international companies like X, Facebook, YouTube, and so on. So increasingly, they've been trying to pressure these platforms to implement censorship. So more and more repressive legislation has been adopted, but then you need to get the platforms to actually enforce it. So if you say a certain type of content is now legal, then how do you get them to actually remove it? And it turns out that this has been much more difficult with the foreign platforms, especially Western platforms, than with the Russian platforms like VK. One of the things that they've also been doing is to then try and promote the domestic ones. So promote the platforms where they're able to influence this much more strongly. So to promote using the Russian search engine, Yandex, to promote using Russian social media like VK, and no longer use the international ones. So, for example, by requiring when a phone is sold in Russia, that these apps should be pre-installed on it. So it should already get you, as soon as you have a new phone, it should already guide you towards the search engine that they're able to influence most. But especially the social media have been very important over the past decade or so for Russian opposition and Russian independent journalism. If you think, for example, about Alexei Navalny, who's been killed, his organization that's been really instrumental in organizing large-scale protests and investigating corruption and so on, they really relied on these Western social media platforms to disseminate their investigations. Because when it was taken down on one platform, it would still be available on the other platform. And for a very long time, these Western platforms also really resisted. So, for example, YouTube was one of the platforms that was really essential for keeping these investigations visible. So for allowing audiences worldwide, like really million audiences, to access these investigations. If they would have been more susceptible to Russian pressure, then of course the opposition would have had less opportunities for reaching its mass audience that they need. But as I mentioned at the beginning, this has now shifted. So for a very long time, Russia was trying to put more and more pressure on these Western platform companies, placing more and more fines on them, threatening to block them and so on. But only in 2022, so after the full-scale invasion, when of course this control over information became even more prominent for the Russian state, we suddenly saw that they went forward and actually started blocking these platforms. Also because now they became more sophisticated in terms of how to actually do it. So they also are more capable of doing it. So they blocked Instagram, they blocked Facebook, and they also blocked X. But now, of course, in 2024, they went one step further. So now we also see that indeed YouTube has been largely restricted. And more recently, also the platform where we are now, Discord, has also been added to the list. This means that the bridges between and the spaces that Russian users in Russia and the outside world can co-inhabit have become more limited. So of course, people will always say, well, you can just use a VPN. But as I mentioned before, also there, Russia is doing much more in trying to limit what kind of VPN services are actually available. So it's officially illegal for VPNs to allow you to access censored websites, for example. But of course, that's the beauty of VPNs, that they would do that. But they've become more and more sophisticated in even being able to detect and also block very prominent VPN services. So it's becoming more and more difficult there as well. So social media platforms are very important, but at the same time, we might even go one level down. Because when we look at, for example, app stores, we have an even smaller number of suppliers. So when you think of internet infrastructures having all kinds of bottlenecks, choke points, then often app stores are very, very important. So they determine what kind of apps you can use, which apps can have a large reach. So when, for example, Apple decides to remove something from their app store, this has very big implications. So of course, they've also become a target of pressure. For some time, these companies resisted. But the first time we saw that they caved was in 2021, when there were Russian parliamentary elections, when there was a strategic voting app that was launched. So the idea was that opposition votes, when they get spread out across multiple candidates, so even in fraudulent elections, that's not good, because we want to undermine the position of the party in power. But if we can coordinate, if everyone votes for the same, candidate that is not connected to United Russia, then we can undermine the position of this party of power. There was an app that you could then say, this is where I will vote, and then it would recommend which candidate you should then vote for. So it was very easy for Russia to block the website in Russia and so on, but then they also wanted to get it removed from these app stores. And in this case, they actually succeeded. And what appears to have been most influential is the fact that Russia also requires you to have a legal representation in the country itself, and they were able to then say, okay, we will prosecute your local employees, for example. So this is what we often dub as hostage-taking laws, so that they're able, that there are actual people there that you might prosecute, that you might hold hostage. And that is it's one of those things to really exercise pressure on these companies. This is an example of dissemination, how they can target it. But then there's another level where it becomes even more murky, even more difficult, also for us to really perceive. And that's about the visibility. And even when you look at platform moderation, there's also been a shift. The platforms more and more, they don't remove content, but they just downrank it. They make it less visible. And that's quite difficult also for internet censorship scholars to actually detect. But here I have a case that that we were able to really show what was going on. Because of course, search engines is also one of those things that really, really influences visibility. Because we all just use the top search results. And many people really rely on search engines for accessing the internet itself. Very rarely people still remember where they would actually want to go. And if you have only a few suppliers again, then they become very, very important. So what kind of decisions do, in this case, Google as the Western search engine available in Russia and Yandex as the more popular Russian alternative, what kind of decisions do they take? Russian government has tried to influence this as well. So trying to influence what actually comes up when you search for certain terms, trying to pressure them, trying to manually interfere even. And of course, here we again had the difference between Google as the Western platform, which by no means perfect, and then Yandex, that is the company that has been more susceptible to pressure. So let's look at a particular example, and it was again also connected to the same election, so the same smart voting app. Because one very silly thing happened there as well, and that was that there was a company trading in wool that registered the trademark of smart voting, which of course is a very silly thing. And then there was a court decision where they forbade search engines to give any results for the query. So there was a court order that said, if you Google smart voting, the search engine should basically say, I don't know, I have no results for you. So our question was, how did they actually implement it? That we looked at this during the election. And what we found was that there indeed was a big difference, where on the one hand, Yandex was complying, and so they were not linking to the official resources. Well, Google was not complying, so they were linking to the official resources where voters could get the information about the strategic voting. But of course, you then also have to give something else. If you remove certain links, you also have to offer something else. So what did they recommend instead? And what we found interesting was that in Yandex, it was largely replaced also by more conspiracy leaning. So negative about this campaign and more conspiracies about what the actual objectives were. So this is one example where we were really able to look into a case where we see on the one hand, the Russian government trying to influence search results. And then we were able to detect how these two different search engines implemented it and what it would mean for users. So if half of the users use the one search engine, what kind of information would they get? What would they think that this smart voting strategy is about? Or if they use the other search engine, what is their image of politics then? So just to conclude for now, and then looking forward to hopping into the Q&A. The unfortunate trend that we have today, and that I'm very happy that we're able to talk about today, is that throughout the world, internet censorship is increasing. And here, of course, we also have debates, even within the European Union, that lean more and more towards more intervention, more state intervention. So if we swap it, then, of course, the concerns about Russian interference in European politics or in American politics is also one of those examples where we see quite a strong push towards more and more restrictions, for example, on social media. And Russia is one of those examples where we see it spill all the way from totally integrated, totally open global internet to censored, increasingly isolated. I should note here that globally and global integrated and uncensored, there was already surveillance from the late 1990s onwards. So on the back end of it, it was not all good. What I've also hoped to show you and to give you some ways of thinking about it is that internet censorship is very, very complex. It is not just about repressive legislation, but it's also about all of those questions about implementation of censorship, implementation of repressive laws, and those relationships between repressive governments and companies. So do they have leverage? Why is one state able to really push platforms to collaborate, to censor for them or not? But also, of course, platforms can over-censor. They can do it themselves as well. So they have a very important role to play, both in facilitating as well as in countering internet censorship, and a role that we really should take serious, even though it is becoming more and more difficult for us to do. It's more and more they're operating in really this gray area where it's not so much really removing content, but much more about downranking all of these subtle differences in visibility that are very difficult for us to detect and prove. But thank you so much for now, and I look forward to continuing into the discussion.
Thank you so much, Marielle. How fascinating to learn a little bit more about the background to internet censorship and how complicated it is to just navigate the Russian internet as well. Just a little plug here, if you are interested in doing open source research on Russian internet, we actually do have trainings on that at Bellingcat. We have fantastic open source researchers who train on just that. And we actually do have a workshop coming up in December. So I'll pop it in the chat in case you're interested in joining that. But first and foremost, if you want to put your questions in the chat now, please go ahead as well. It's just to the left-hand side of the top of your screen. And please pop any questions in there from this point onwards. Marielle, I wanted to ask you, because Russia is often considered a pioneer, let's say, in internet governance and censorship. Could you explain how Russia's approach differs from other authoritarian regimes? And are there any particular strategies or technologies that Russia has pioneered? Or are they simply following a well-thought-out game plan that's already been instrumented by other regimes?
Russia is indeed often seen as being quite unique. The funny thing is that what was traditionally seen as the so-called the Russian model of the internet governance, the internet censorship, they actually no longer do. But that's something I'll come to. So it's often contrasted with the Russian model, so to say, and the Chinese model. And the Chinese model originally was, okay, firewall on the outside, like really restricting what can be accessed, so re-isolating Chinese users and building an entire ecosystem within it, and then having very strict restrictions from outside companies. If you want to operate in a Chinese market, you have to follow our legislation and so on, implemented on a very, very early stage, the early stage of the development of the internet. Russia was the opposite. So again, developed from very open. And the idea initially was that we saw that they were already from the 2010s and onwards, they were trying to influence online discussions, but that this was not done initially by restricting, so not censoring website, for example. That's only possible legally since 2012, started doing it in 2013. And they did not do that. It was much more about paying bloggers when blogging was still very prominent. Those kinds of manipulations. Bots is something that really emerged already then. Of course, not just in Russia, but also in terms of trying to interfere in Ukraine already early on. So these kinds of manipulation, so participating in online discourses, trying to manipulate them, trying to change the balance of conversations, that was really seen as the Russian model initially. So it was more sophisticated, in a sense, way of trying to influence online debates in a way that is more difficult for users to actually detect, that they don't notice, okay, I'm running into this restriction. They just think that other people think this way, or maybe I am the only one who thinks like this, and so on. But that was originally seen as the Russian model. Of course, over the past years, they've shifted away, and especially now, of course, they've went all the way into the blocking model. But the difficulty that they now encounter is that they did not do this early on. So they actually have to disentangle this very, very complicated amalgamation of all these different technologies. So you see, even now, even though they for quite a number of years have a lot of legislation on trying to get everyone to move from Western technologies and Chinese technology to Russian-produced technologies, that in reality, this is very, very hard to do. And oftentimes, they don't even have the domestic production capacity, for example. There's something like having the type of servers that a company would need. They force them to use the Russian ones, but then they actually the companies say, well, they're just not good enough. We cannot actually do that. So it's proven to be very difficult. So in that sense, the original Russian model no longer is what Russia actually does today. But they are still very innovative in the sense that the way that they now are able to censor, this is something that they've been implementing since 2019 under what they call the Russian Internet Sovereignty legislation, that it is actually very sophisticated. So they have a more sophisticated form of DPI, so deep packet inspection. But the way it is organized is that they installed the special devices with all of the internet service providers and all the big telecom providers. And they are able to access those directly. So previously, they had a list of ISPs have to block these and these websites, and they had to update the list twice a day and then indeed block access for their clients. But now they can do it directly. So they're no longer reliant on these internet service providers, no longer reliant on the telecommunication operators. They can do it centrally. So it allows them to filter traffic in a more advanced fashion, but also to do it in a way that the telecommunication operators, they don't even have access to these rooms where these devices are. They cannot do that. And another advantage, as we see it in terms of internet censorship, is that it allows them to do this on a quite local level. So to really target particular areas. And that, of course, is another sophistication that then can be exported to other countries. So that, unfortunately, is an area where it looks like they are innovating, where it looks like this is actually very effective and relatively cheap as well. And that is, of course, also another factor that might ease this, like other countries adopting this similar kind of model as well, which is concerning. At the same time, I think you also mentioned the idea of like, are they very strategic? Are they following a plan? And this is the thing where, just because I've been following this for some 10 years now, where I always want to push back because it is so damn messy. If you just look at even how this legislation is being made and then how it's implemented, and they say one thing, but in practice, it actually doesn't work. And it actually is very messy. But of course, the end result still is the same. So the end result still is that the Russian internet today is very highly censored. There's a lot of repression for online activity, and it's becoming more and more difficult for those outside, like who have been forced to live outside of Russia, to still engage with Russian audiences. So even though, no, it is not really thought through, yes, they make a lot of mistakes. They have a lot of ideas that actually are not possible. The end result, unfortunately, still is a highly censored internet.
Super interesting to hear how messy it is behind the scenes. And I want to return back to the discussion about what lessons we can learn from this for future censorship in other countries, for example, as you touched on. But first, you mentioned, I know you said that blocking is now the new place they're concentrating on. But you did mention the bot farms, and Batman had asked a question. Great name, by the way, on Discord. They asked, on top of directly censoring information, Russian government is notorious for its troll activity. Seeing how effective Russian trolls are at disturbing and diverting any constructive discussion, both in Russian and English language segments and across platforms, is there any visibility on initiatives that could be coming up to counter that? And how could the open source community help here?
That's a very good question. So indeed, this is another one of those areas where we often think of Russia as being quite innovative and quite effective. So already for quite some years, of course, initially starting with the original troll factory, so to say, so the Internet Research Agency, first operating mostly domestically. We've seen also a lot of very early on activity, of course, in Ukraine. And now we're switching to some new organizations because, of course, after the head, Prigozhin, was killed, the Internet Research Agency is no more. But, of course, there are other partners or other parties who are very willing to take over those government tenders. So we see that this is indeed one of the areas where there's a lot of activity and where for quite some years, Russia has also been quite apt in the sense that it is quite tailored to the particular audiences that they try to influence. So this actually requires skill, like it or not, it does. So to be able to analyze what is going on in a certain society, to analyze how you might influence that, what you would want to amplify, how you can destabilize a society by picking up on certain topics. This is something that, for example, for many years, China has been left out at actually doing. So this has been, because of that, of course, quite a big concern. A personal concern I have right now is that we might often be overestimating the effectiveness of a lot of these activities. So it's relatively easy for us to detect inauthentic behaviors. So to try and figure out like how active are these networks, I think that that by now there's a lot of capacity in doing this. There's a lot of organizations that work on this. At the same time, what worries me is that oftentimes we then very quickly make the step from activity to saying, okay, that there has been engagement, which oftentimes there's very little engagement. So, or a lot of engagement with others, but only within the same form, so to say. So very little engagement actually beyond that. And then the point that is often left out entirely, of course, is what is the actual effect of this? So does it influence anyone's perceptions and so on? At the same time, of course, the fact that we see so much activity and that we're talking about this activity, that might in itself already have effects, right? Just the idea that we think that we are being threatened, that there's an outside actor that's interfering in our debates, that our communications and our public debates are not safe, or that they're not secure from this outside interference. So even that already can be very powerful. So this was something that I think is quite challenging about the moment where we are now. So of course, we went all the way from an underestimation of the threat. It took quite a long time from 2016 onwards for this to be really recognized, even though within our research community, we've seen these activities for much longer, especially Ukraine has been fighting them for much, much longer. It took quite a long time for it to be taken seriously. But now we are at the point where it is taken seriously and where sometimes we're lacking really the connection to, is it really effective, or are we just granting them effectiveness and just assuming that actually it is effective? And this also doesn't really do justice to the fact that a lot of our average citizens, they actually are able to tell what is going on. They actually have their own opinions and they might not be influenced that easily. It might take a lot more about the social interactions that they have, but that is much more important for us to understand how public opinion is made today. And what can we do against it? Of course, the most important thing is indeed awareness, but just in general, awareness about how do these online spaces work. So digital literacy is, of course, the common thing that's always being proposed. But I do think that in a general sense, that is just important. So not just about knowing how the internet works, but also in general, how do media work? So if you want to support that also younger generations, that they trust certain sources of information, it can be really beneficial if they understand how does journalism work? How does OSINT work? How do we actually come to knowledge? How can you investigate things yourself? Who can you really trust? So who are the sources that you might return to and why? That can be actually very, very supportive. Of course, we still need the platforms to be very active, because we do not need these very big campaigns. We do not need all of these inauthentic behavior on those platforms that are trying to manipulate online discussions. So very active responses from those platforms, they will be essential moving forward. And this is also where, of course, European regulations like the DSA, they really push platforms to take the next step. Also in terms of becoming more transparent about the decisions that they make. And also, hopefully, at some point, that we get better access for researchers to data so that we're able to investigate what really happens there. And maybe we're able to then say more about, indeed, there's engagement, for example, and how the activities that we see there, how they might influence how people actually communicate.
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't agree more with what you're talking about. I mean, there's actually an example of this kind of bot network that's been attacking media houses in that tweet that I shared in the chat from Elliot Higgins, our founder. If you've been following Bellingcat's social media accounts recently, you'll have seen that there's been a fake news campaign against us and many other media organizations. What we did was we sat back and tried to monitor the engagement level and how quick they were being responded to. And it was very obvious that they were just echoing themselves. And when we didn't echo them, they didn't get as much visibility as they did when we were raising awareness of the fact that these were out there. It's quite interesting as well as how they're often targeting fact checkers and news journalists as well, sending them in DMs to try and, again, get them verified or fact checked so that there's amplification of those original claims as well. So just be careful if you see disinformation campaigns like that, often kind of giving them space and giving them amplification can be more problematic than sitting back and kind of monitoring their networks and which bots are interacting with which. So please do have a look at that.
Thank you so much for making that point. I think that's really, really crucial because, of course, we often think about like the responsibility of citizens or how we might help citizens. But it's much more important, or at least that there are just certain individuals and organizations in a society that are much more influential. So the way that media and also the way that politicians handle these activities is much more important because they determine whether something gets amplified more or less. But they're able to really still play this gatekeeper function, but in a positive sense, in trying to prevent that these activities are actually successful. But what I think is also interesting why you mentioned this particular example, it's because this is a switch that we have seen in the way that Russia engages, in that because it's quite difficult to establish an audience for yourself, right? So if you now create, I don't know, thousands of bots, right? They don't mean anything. So you need an entry point. You need a certain person. You need a certain media that has already established audience or that has some sense of authenticity that then helps you to be amplified or that readers or users got that information from you. So we do see this in the more recent, recently exposed cases, much more examples of this. For example, the U.S. case that was recently disclosed, payments to these very large influencers, that, of course, is much smarter. So it already is established. They already have a large following. They already have a certain credibility with their audience. And you just pay them some money to say certain things. This can be very effective. The same thing also for the doppelganger, where they've been really spoofing, so pretending to be established media outlets, which of course does two things. On the one hand, might get their information out there and might users might trust it. But at the same time, it might also harm the reputation of those established media. So it can actually have both effects. So that is a more recent trend that we've seen that really plays with how we trust certain information sources online. And that, of course, is also another thing to really be aware of.
Absolutely. We've got about 15 minutes left, so please put your questions in the chat. Tony Barrett shared, Hugo Mercier's book, Not Born Yesterday, might be relevant. Interviews include this one and is linked to a YouTube video called 80,000 Hours. Might be worth a check and have a look at that. I wanted to move to Benji123's question now. They've asked, do you have information on how Ukraine is trying to separate itself from the Russian internet, e.g. use of VK in Ukraine, since the countries are so linked culturally and linguistically?
Absolutely. So I do have seen a bracket that my focus is mostly on Russia, but I follow Ukraine very thoroughly as well. And especially also the situation now for occupied territories, because there oftentimes censorship is even more harshly applied than in Russia. So Ukraine has been battling with Russian interference for many, many years. This goes back even way before 2014. And one of the things that they decided to do after the extension of Crimea is to block those Russian online resources, Ukrainian citizens from this Russian information environment and the way that it was playing on Teams. So already then they blocked Russian search engine, Yandex, as well as the most popular Russian social media, VK. At the same time, of course, there's been other forms of Russian influencing that continue beyond that. So they've been actively trying to counter that as well. But that, of course, has been very difficult. So there are also a lot of concerns about some Ukrainian media with Russian-linked ties. And then, of course, it becomes much more messy. So there's all kinds of very important legislation about media pluralism, that we need to have pluralism within our media systems and then diversity of viewpoints and so on. So actually determining when you can prove that the media is actually so much linked to an outside power that is trying to undermine the state, that it justifies restricting them. That is actually a very, very high bar. This has been really a challenge for Ukraine, but also something where they've actually by now accumulated a lot of knowledge and a lot of also capacity. And of course, after the full-scale invasion, there's also been so much mobilization within Ukrainian society, which also really helps in shielding against this. The reinforcement of Ukrainian language and increasingly also those who maybe grew up more with the Russian language dominant. Most Ukrainians are bilingual, but those who maybe at home spoke more Russian, you see more and more switching to Ukrainian entirely. But this, of course, also disentangles that space much and much more. So the challenge, I think, for Ukraine right now is that how do you reach the audiences that the Ukrainians that are in occupied territories? Because as I mentioned, as soon as Russia occupies territory, we see, of course, repression of the population. This also involves a lot of violence, a lot of torture and all of that. But it also involves taking over of all the communication infrastructures. So it means that now Russian propaganda is brought in and censorship is brought in as well. So complete rerouting of internet traffic via Russian network and so on. Sort of deprives citizens there from outside information. This, of course, is tactical, right? It's to deprive them from connections to Ukraine and from information from there and to expose them to Russian propaganda. This is really a big challenge for Ukraine. So if we're pushing towards liberation of these territories, then it's important to try and keep engaging with the citizens there and to provide them with independent information of what is going on. And that is particularly hard today.
I had a very interesting conversation with a Ukrainian journalist a couple of weeks ago about a Ukrainian print newspaper that's being distributed on the front lines because of internet restrictions and the value of having kind of Ukrainian language on the front line there and news and updates from back home. It's fascinating. Guy Stafford.
And also, of course, there's so much damage to infrastructure to begin with, right? Mm-hmm. So just the reliability of having internet access is absolutely not a given. There's so much destruction of energy infrastructure, of communications infrastructure, and of course a lot of repair work is being done. But still, there are just so many outages, even just with the electricity outages. Mm-hmm. So there's not necessarily very reliable communication possible everywhere in Ukraine at all times, which of course makes it difficult. And then even more so indeed in occupied territories where some of them are deprived of this entirely. So these kinds of local newspapers, they are able to really provide for those scenes.
So we're talking about occupied territories, but Geis has asked, have there been any efforts to measure / understand reach over citizens outside of their borders at scale? So Russian citizens abroad.
So there actually is quite some research on that, but at the same time, it's really difficult to talk about it because there's so many diverse groups when we talk about this topic. Because, of course, Russia tries to influence across its borders in general. This is where, for example, RT has been one of the primary instruments for many, many years. So RT broadcasting in all the different languages. Within Europe, this is restricted, but again, in many countries in the world, actually, this is not. So even today, RT is still very important. And all kinds of associated other communication forms that came with it. So this is just in general trying to promote Russian perspectives, which of course often include a lot of disinformation. But Russian citizens abroad, of course, is a particular category where they target them for different reasons. One is indeed to provide certain information to try and keep them positive towards the Russian state. That might even then also influence the domestic public opinion there. But of course, there's also a repressive side to this. And this is something that within the new project that you mentioned earlier, what we'll be doing over the next few years or so is to really focus on also the repressive side of it. So how does Russia try to repress information across its borders, which it actively does? So when we again think about the role of those platforms, and then what we've often seen, and also for Ukrainian journalists, for example, is the false flagging on platforms. So it's saying this account is violating the platform rules, or this account is doing this and this. And if there's enough of these complaints, then oftentimes an account at least gets suspended for a bit, and it might even get blocked. So these kinds of manipulation of reporting mechanisms is, again, one of those ways in which they might be able to influence that as well. But the reason why I mentioned it's complicated is because, of course, a lot of this is done in Russian language as well. And there it becomes very messy of who these target audiences actually are, because they can be very diverse. This can be former Soviet citizens who've been in Germany for 20, 25 years. This can be recent emigres in the Baltics. It is a very, very diverse group that they might want to target or that might be affected by this. So partly this is just Russian domestic propaganda influencing across its borders. Partly this is actually tailored to reach particular audiences at certain times.
Yeah, Timu just asked as well in the chat about sensitive and strategic territories, if they also have the same kind of censorship, for example, in the Russian Arctic. But I think you kind of referred to that a little bit in your last answer. I also linked to your project in the chat as well, if you want to check that out. It's in the chat now, the Horizon Project. We've only got about 6 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you, because you're talking about how Russia's strategy at the moment is blocking and banning, particularly of social media apps, but I wanted to ask you about the Russian government's response to France's arrest of Telegram CEO, and how what you found from that kind of government response, and whether and what Telegram as an app, what role that plays within Russia and in regards to censorship.
Thank you so much for that question. The Telegram is such a fascinating case where I think that there's so much that we actually do not know, both about the platform as well as its founder, as well as what it actually does and the links that it has with various governments. It's one of the platforms that is increasingly very, very influential, but also very, very intransparent. So after the arrest, they are suddenly becoming a little bit more proactive, a little bit more transparent, but we still know very, very little. But the interesting thing about Russia and Telegram is, of course, that for some people, they think, okay, this is a Russian app because the founder is Russian. So there, the idea for a very long time has been like, no, it actually might be against the Russian state, because it was indeed the founders, the two brothers, the Durov brothers, who initially founded the social media platform VK, then were forced out of VK, and then they created Telegram as a messenger just able to resist pressure from government, so able to shield you from a repressive government that wants you to have access to your data and so on. So that it actually protects you. This was also why it became so popular, both in Russia itself as well as elsewhere, especially because they were actually very good at circumventing censorship. So if, for example, some years ago when there were these very large protests in Belarus, the internet was being shut down. It's very difficult to access all kinds of resources. But Telegram was the most resistant. So when they were not able to use WhatsApp, for example, then oftentimes people were able to use Telegram, therefore it became very important. So they also really cultivated this image that they are like on the side of the protesters, that they are really reinforcing them. So even in Russia, it was blocked for a few years, or officially blocked from 2018 to 2020. But in practice, not really, because they were not able to. And some of the Russian government officials even continue using it, even though officially they were blocking it, which of course is one of those messy things that I always want to stress, that they can do things at the same time. So they can block a resource, but at the same time have the spokesperson for the presidential administration to still use it and not be ashamed of that. So the challenging thing right now is, of course, that on one hand, they've really cultivated this image of being supporting protests and protecting you against authoritarian states. At the same time, the type of open communication that they promote, which leans more to like libertarian ideas about information freedom, it actually doesn't protect you as well, right? So it also leaves a lot of room for propaganda, a lot of room for fraud, a lot of room for criminal activities. And this is, of course, where it becomes problematic, and also the reason why now France indeed decided to then arrest the CEO. So if you do not want to communicate with us, which they were apparently not doing, if you do not want to remove, in this case, this was about child sexual abuse materials, if you do not want to remove those fast enough, then we will actually try and prosecute you as the CEO and hold you accountable for this. So for holding you accountable for facilitating these activities. And what the Russians then did is, of course, the most, both surprising and unsurprising, is that suddenly they readopted Durov. So they said, oh, but look, there in the West, they speak about the global open internet, they speak about freedom of expression online and against censorship, but look at what they're actually doing. They are now prosecuting Durov, and they're trying to restrict Telegram and trying to enforce state regulation and execute or exert state power over them. So look at the West that is being hypocritical again. And actually, everything is much better in Russia. So Durov should just come back, and then everything will be okay. So it's a very complicated case again, where I think right now we also have a lot of open questions also about Durov himself and about his positionality. So he always claimed that he was not able to go back to Russia, but now Russian investigative journalists have found out that actually he's been flying back and forth quite often. So there's increasingly doubts about how should we really view this. So how, which governments do they actually have connections with? What are those connections? Are they trustworthy or not? But I think in general, it's always important to stress that within the security community, it's very clear that Telegram is not as secure as they often claim to be. And that if you are in a vulnerable position, and if this is really important for you or for your own security, the Telegram is not the app to use for you.
Yeah, it's a fascinating case. I wanted to ask you last question, and if we could keep this short and sweet, that'd be amazing, if it's even possible. What lessons as researchers can we take from those researching within Russia's internet censorship for other regions that may be increasingly facing stricter online restrictions? I'm thinking in regards to election periods in a lot of different regions. What lessons can we take from Russia's censorship into those?
I think the most important lesson is that things are easily lost. I think that especially for us in democratic countries, is one of the important things. And that the decentralization of the internet is actually the crucial point. So the more that we have an internet infrastructure that has a lot of bottlenecks, that has a limited number of platforms available, that does not allow interoperability, the more vulnerable it becomes to state control. So I think that the push for, on the one hand, defending the right to encryption is really, really crucial for everyone, but also in trying to maintain this core idea of what makes the internet resilient. So not just resilient against what was initially the objective, right? Resilient against nuclear attack, but actually resilient to censorship. And this comes through pushing back against monopolization, pushing back against these very big companies occupying the few bottlenecks that really influence the way that the entire internet works. Another thing, maybe the last thing to stress, is the importance of communities like this one. So the importance of having digital rights defenders, of having journalists, and of having these connections that allow us to then actually draw attention to cases that signal bad developments and to be able to start organizing and pushing back. It's really, really important, and it's quicker lost than it is regained.
Thank you so much, Marielle, for your time today. It's been fascinating listening to you. I put the Auto Archiver link in the chat in case you haven't seen it yet. Archive, archive, archive. As Marielle just said, the link's in the chat for you to do just that. Thank you so much for your time, Marielle. Our Discord stage talk will not be back in 2 weeks' time, and there's going to be a little bit of a break. But if you have checked out our social media in the last hour or so, you'll know that we have a 10-year anniversary celebration next week, which is about 70 stage talks in one. So please tune in. It will be live on our YouTube on the 13th and 14th of November, full of incredible talks just like this one. So do check that out. But again, thank you so much, Marielle, and thank you to everybody who's joined us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the Stage Talk. If you'd like to catch a Stage Talk live where you can ask the guest questions, join the Bellingcat Discord server by visiting www.discord.gg/Bellingcat. The music you've heard is titled Dawn by Newer Self and is courtesy of Artlist.